Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Sheila.
And hoo boy, are we gonna see a bleak episode this week. We're starting off in a bad place, and then it gets fun.
Yeah, a really bad place.
Such a downer. But I think we should just get right to it. Would you like to synopsize the first episode, please? According to Wikipedia.
Yes. Directed by and written by Edward Alan Bernero. While investigating a series of gang-related killings in Los Angeles, the BAU learns that the crime scene mirrors drawings from a graphic novel written by a man suffering from severe post-traumatic stress disorder. No, not quite.
Not exactly.
They find the mirror, they find the drawings afterwards.
They he's already under arrest when they see the drawings.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. It's an interesting episode because it is in no way structured like a traditional Criminal Minds episode.
Not at all.
The weird part is every time the way the episode is structured, every time they cut back to the team, it feels strange.
Yeah.
Like, it kind of feels like this episode should have gone all of the way with it and told this entirely from the killer's point of view and just seen the team on the periphery.
Yeah.
You know, like one of those good episodes of The X-Files where they show you what it looks like from the outside when The X-Files comes to town. You know, but they cut back to the team a bunch of times, and then we have Reed bad-mouthing house cats. Like, come on! Yeah, house cats are monsters, but it's a weird time to bring it up.
These three episodes, I got so tired of Reed by the end of them. But anyway, yeah, this episode, like, the funny thing is there isn't an awful lot to say about it, except that Malcolm in the Middle did a wonderful job of...
His name is Frankie Muniz, but yes, he did.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Everybody wants to call him Malcolm in the Middle. I'm sure he struggles with that every day of his life.
Well,
especially because who on earth could tell you what the character's last name was? I can't.
No. No.
I can't tell you what the character's last name was. You know?
No,
Malcolm in the Middle. Like, that's, you know, you can maybe be able to remember the rest of the characters' names as well, but you can't. I can't tell you their last name. Did they have a last name? Who knows? But yeah, that's kind of an interesting thing now that I think about it. No, it's interesting because I'm sure every day of his life he struggles with the aftermath of having been a child star. But honestly, he does great this episode. He really does.
Yeah. I mean, it is such a sad episode. And you do, I think that the focus still... Like, what I take away from it, like, I can barely remember what the team does in this episode because, you know, it's just so terrible how he, I can remember the first time watching this, like some of these episodes I can, right? That, you know, just what the hell happened? It can't be just that his girlfriend left him, right?
No, of course not. Yeah.
And then you find out she was pregnant, and then you find out, right?
She was raped and tortured and murdered right in front of him, and blah, 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 blah.
And who the, like, and you just go, and he had no support system?
Nope. His agent hasn't seen him in months.
In months.
Jesus Christ. I mean, the thing is, if his girlfriend left him, I understand the agent doing that, but... You're a terrible agent if you haven't seen him in months since he was stabbed almost to death and his fiancée was raped and tortured and murdered.
Yeah.
While she was pregnant. Although, no, I guess, I'm sure nobody knew she was pregnant. You know, it's like,
I'm sure
that wasn't in the... He did. I'm sure his agent didn't, because it's not like that. She had just found out.
Well, it doesn't matter.
And she had just told him.
Yeah.
No, but I'm saying he didn't know how bad it was. I will. I'm not defending the agent's lack of attention, but yeah. Well,
no. But he almost died.
Yeah, he almost died too. No, and it's like, you're a terrible support system, dude.
Yeah.
Like, you're supposed to be the guy who stands up for this guy, and no, you are terrible at this. Yeah, so yeah. I have no sympathy for his agent. Although, to say the show, his agent right away knows there's something seriously wrong and turns him in immediately.
Well, he knows there's something wrong and tries to get him to a psychiatrist.
Yeah, because the minute he doesn't know. Yeah, the minute he talks to him, he's like, oh, he doesn't know his fiance's dead.
Yeah.
That's a problem. Yeah. And but he doesn't call the psychiatrist right away. He waits until he sees on the news that there have been brutal murders in the style of that comic book. And then he's like, oh, okay, I know who did it then.
But it's not that hard. He might have that's the funny thing is he might have, because Burden of Truth has just this, never mind. It's a different show.
Oh, but okay.
What happens is the brother of one of the characters is having a severe schizophrenic breakdown.
Right.
And what he does is calls the cops to take him away because the guy won't voluntarily. He needles his brother into hitting him, and then he calls the
cops. So he can call the cops to...
And charge him with assault and get him put into the emergency. Because when he was going to talk to the psychiatrist, his brother, the schizophrenic brother, took his truck, drove it out into the middle of a field and set it on fire.
Okay.
So the brother finally realized there's nothing he can do.
No.
And so he needled him into hitting him and then charged him and had him taken away into the emergency psych.
Which, yeah.
Eval.
Yeah, a psychological hold, as they call it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They put a psychological hold on him. And yeah, that's the right thing to do in that situation. Like, it can't feel good to do that to your brother, but that's 100% the right thing to do in that situation.
Yeah, that's how this, but to give this agent, okay, so he hadn't seen him, he hadn't heard from him, he was off doing other things.
Yeah.
You know,
he's got other clients.
Then came to pick him up and realized, okay, he doesn't even know that his girlfriend's dead.
Yeah.
And okay, but he doesn't know, and he sees the new drawings, but he doesn't know at that time.
Oh, no. At that time.
Right?
So, I honestly think the minute you realize he's so dissociated that he doesn't know his girlfriend is dead,
yeah.
I feel like that's the time. I mean, he's definitely a danger to himself. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't know that he's a danger to other people yet, but he's definitely a danger to himself. So it's like, I would have liked it had we found out that the agent immediately, like, called his family to see if they knew anything, and literally like the next day is when the news conference happened, so the agent hasn't had time to do anything other than that. That would have been nice, because at least then the agent would be shown to, you know, be more involved.
Well,
the episode doesn't need it, and the episode is honestly packed with content already.
Yeah, it doesn't need it, and that would be nice, but agents are not exactly known
for that kind of behavior.
Yeah, no,
and that's fine. That's fine.
You
it's
know,
not like
agents are not people who are empathetic and all that sort of stuff, right?
No, that is not a quality you are necessarily looking for in an agent,
or that you're going to find in an agent.
That's true. Yeah, I'm sure that's right.
But the episode itself. This one, I mean, it is. It just feels very, again, there was a couple of episodes back too. It's very straightforward. Like you can just see this and you can feel it. It's well done. It's well directed. Like, and the images, like the whole thing just.
When he does the Frank Miller vision. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When he does the Sin City Frank Miller vision.
Yeah.
That's very nice.
Like the whole thing is just so.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting because the show does misunderstand a few things. It really does not seem to understand what a tiny amount of money is involved in comic books, what a minuscule amount of money is involved in working in the field of comic books, unless you create something that is adapted into a TV show or movie. There's no money in comic books at all. And, you know, because they're riding around in limos and such. I'm like, yeah, not so much.
Well, maybe the agent has the limos because he's got other big clients.
Maybe, right.
And this is just his friend, right? Remember that they were friends before he became his agent.
Oh, totally. And the other thing, though, is that they're like, I'll just call your publisher and see about this new project you're working on. And I'm like, Yeah, I mean, this guy would have to be a giant big wheel in the comic book industry for that kind of thing to fly. Like, there's three or four people who can be like, I've got a new idea for a book and get anyone to sign off on that. Because you got to remember, this year's what, 2008?
2007.
So this is before people, there was, you know, you could just self-publish something on the internet.
Yeah.
And like, you still had to go through a major publisher to do a comic book at this time. So the idea that there's anybody out there who can just say to a publisher, I've got a new book for you. And they would just say, sure. There's like three people who could do that. And honestly, I mean, it's a time when, and this is true, like, Alan Moore would just go and work for whoever because he had to pay tax bills.
Yeah.
This is a funny story. Alan Moore wrote a bunch of unpleasant comic book things for Avatar Press, which is not a good publisher. I'll just say that. And it's true. The what happened was he didn't want any of the money from Watchmen, right? So he just said he had a contract and couldn't say no to it. And he's like, give all the money to Dave Gibbons. But he did not handle the tax burden of that gift correctly. And he ended up owing a bunch of tax money on money he didn't get. And so this is a true story because Alan Moore has a level of prestige. And this is why he's one of the few people who could do this. So he called up Avatar Press, who we know will publish anything. They're not a good publisher. And he said, I need, you know, something like $25,000 for a tax bill. And they're like, get us 120 pages worth of comics and we'll just give you that money. We literally don't care what it is. It just needs to be 120 pages of new content that Alan Moore wrote.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly it.
There's a guy on, there's like three guys on that level. So let's talk a little about the real life thing this is based on. It's not based on a true story at all, but there was this movie called The Crow.
Yes.
And so what happened was, in real life, James O'Barr's girlfriend or fiance was killed by a hit-and-run driver. And just completely out of nowhere. And as his way of processing this horrible random act of violence, he created The Crow, a story of a guy who he and his girlfriend were attacked and she was raped and murdered and he was killed by a bunch of random criminals out on the side of the road one day. And he comes back from the dead to get revenge. And that was adapted into the film The Crow, which of course is remembered primarily for being the movie that killed Brandon Lee.
Yeah.
And that is a tragic story in and of, like, that is a whole other tragic story in and of itself. Like the death of Brandon Lee, it's horrible, but that is the impetus for this story. There is no truth behind anything that happens in this episode. It's all inspired by The Crow, which is fantastic, by the way. Yes.
By the way. Yeah. No, The Crow is, the movie is fantastic. When I'm going, but you would think that Penelope or Reed would have figured this out.
Well, yeah, but anyway. I think in the world of the show, I think they want us to believe that in the world of the show, The Crow doesn't exist. That life isn't imitating art. because otherwise you got to say, you know, this is a lot like the plot of The Crow, come to think of it. Do you know what my biggest problem with the episode is?
What?
Is that would the LAPD bother calling them in on this? Like, someone's cutting up gang members. Like, is that something they really think is worth federalizing?
Well, let me make this assumption. Edward Alan Bernero wanted to write this story.
Yes.
Right? It's true. He wanted to film this story.
Exactly. So
he had to make it. The only way to do that is somehow or another get the BAU in.
Oh, totally.
Whether it makes any sense
or not. I find it a little weird within the world of the show because he never kills anybody innocent. He never even kills any bystander who just happens to be hanging out with the criminals or like someone there to buy drugs or one of their girlfriends, anything like that.
Yeah.
Like, he literally just kills the people he's there to kill.
Yeah.
Right? And so first off, excellent targeting. Malcolm. Thumbs up.
Yeah, he knew what they all looked like, and he just went after them.
Yeah, he just went after them because he couldn't. Yeah, like he's an artist. He has a great visual sense, and he remembered exactly what all of them looked like, and he could not forget it.
Yeah.
And that's what he was tortured by.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it was all subconscious, and it was all happening in his psychotic breaks. I mean, he didn't know he was doing it, but that part of his mind completely remembered. Like, in the same way that the human mind always knows exactly what time it is, whether or not you have access to that information, he had the access to the information of what all these, exactly what all of these guys looked and sounded like, and so he was able to just wander the streets finding them at night.
Yeah.
So yeah, like, it's... The you're right that it's all just, we have to overlook that part and just say, well, you know, Edward wanted to do some stuff about Frank Miller and the Crow because he loved Frank Miller and the Crow. So he just did it. And that's, that's why this, but I honestly question whether they would bother calling the FBI about this, just because honestly, like they'll work the case. They'll try and solve the case. But if gang members are just killing each other, I don't think, which is what they assume at first. I don't think they're going to worry too much about it or make a big deal about it.
No, I don't even think the local FBI guys would have been involved.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't even, you're right. I don't think they even would have called the LA, you know,
FBI.
Office of the FBI.
Yeah.
Like, why would they?
Why would they? I mean, this is Los Angeles. They've got good solid cops who can, and they're killing black guys.
Well, no, Hispanic guys.
Oh, Hispanic.
It's
Hispanic
gang. Hispanic
guys, yeah.
Yeah, it was a Hispanic gang. Like, this is the kind of thing where it's, the term cops like to use is public service crime. And that's a horrible thing to say, but that is how back in the day cops used to look at it. I don't know if they still look at it that way in LA, but it is famously true that if a criminal kills another criminal over territory or whatever, cops are less likely to worry about it if criminals kill what they call citizens, you know, tax-paying people who go to work and do their jobs and, like, take the commute. If somebody like that dies, they have to look into it. But, and the sad fact is, if the media reports that a gang member shot another gang member, people don't worry about where they live, and they don't think about moving, and they don't think about taking their business out of town.
Right.
It's only when, you know, people who pay taxes and go to sporting events and blah, 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 start getting shot that people start to really worry about it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is my fundamental problem with the main plot of the episode. But again, like you say, we just have to give them that because Ed Bernero had a story he wanted to tell.
Yeah. I think that that's
I think you're right.
That's there.
As much as I love to nitpick, I have to admit to you're right. So I just want to, and now let's end this comment on this episode with two of the worst quotes in the history of the show. It opens with a quote from Clive Barker about how Superman is a nice face on alien influences, and I'm like, no, you've completely misread Superman, Clive Barker. Like, I guess I wasn't expecting Clive Barker to know anything about Superman, but. No.
After all, his hero is Pinhead. But anyway. Know, right?
No, Superman is the ultimate immigrant story. It's not that he's an alien influence. It's he is making the point that only an immigrant can truly understand what's great about America.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is what Superman is for. That is the message of Superman. He is the ultimate immigrant who makes it good in America. Because he comes to America and he uses his skills to make America a better place. And he improves the country by being there. And he appreciates America more than Americans do. And if you think of him as a citizen of the world, which you should, because Superman is a has honorary citizenship of almost every country on Earth. That's just a weird piece of trivia. That doesn't come up much in the comics, but it does. Like, most countries on Earth are like, yeah, no, we're giving Superman honorary membership. He's Superman. Everybody loves him. But yes, if you think of him as an honorary citizen of Earth, he's again someone who can see the greatness of humanity because he is an adoptee, like, of humanity. Because is he technically human? No, but he's human in every way that matters, right? And he is the best of humanity because he's chosen to be human rather than being born to it. So yeah, Clive Barker doesn't understand Superman at all. And then we get to the end, and Penelope Garcia doesn't understand Frank Miller at all.
Oh, I know.
Like, no, Derek is not a hard-boiled detective.
I know.
That is not Derek at all.
No. I'm going, oh my so God. Who, so Ed, you never really.
You don't really get hard-boiled.
Well, no, I don't think, maybe Ed has never seen, read Sin City.
No, he, well, he must he have. Obviously
he must have.
The whole thing is patterned after Sin City.
Sin City, yeah, I was just going to say. I mean, other than, you know, the BAU part. Yeah, the whole thing is just Sin City.
I guess they were just trying to make it, they were just trying to make it all lock together, and that's why they have Penelope say that, but I'm like, yeah, it's just, the excuse they have to have Penelope say this thing is so ludicrous, because that's not Derek at all.
No.
Derek is not a hard-boiled detective who lives on the edge and is broken by the world, but he always does the right thing. Like, no, that's not Derek.
Oh, shit.
I know, right? No. You are not describing Derek Morgan.
No, this is not Sam Spade. I'm sorry. No.
Derek Morgan, for, you know, all of his good parts, is a petty bully who, yeah. You know, who helps things, who makes the world a better place. But he's kind of a petty jerk as well.
Yeah, and every now and then says maybe the right thing.
Yeah, he does say the right thing. Quite frequently he says the right thing. But no, he is not a stoic, hard-boiled detective up against a corrupt system.
No, not.
That's not he is the system.
He is, yeah, that's exactly the point. He is the system.
Absolutely, Derek Morgan is the system. All right, so let's move on to our second episode. The mildly preposterous episode, Birthright.
I know, but it was so nice to see Morgan Shepherd.
Isn't Morgan Shepherd the best? Oh. All right, we'll talk about him in a minute, but get to it.
Birthright. When a series of mutilation murders in Fredericksburg, Virginia, mimic a series of crimes that occurred over two decades earlier, the BAU is forced to interview a survivor of the original spree in order to identify the unsub. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, I have one big question.
Yeah.
Why the hell did the mother keep all of the journals?
I don't know. No, it's insane. That's the key part. So she goes home. She runs off because her husband is too violent, right?
Yeah.
Because he's a violent monster and she doesn't feel safe having the kid around. He begs her to come back. She comes back. She finds out, right? She finds out that he's been killing these women. She murders him that day. Says he fell into his combine harvester. But then just leaves all the journals lying around?
Yeah. I mean, that did, and I can't let that one go. Not for the sake of the show. Like, no, I can,
you can't.
You know, I mean, I'm one who will allow the show an awful lot of latitude, but
you famously give it much more latitude than I do.
And I am just sort of sitting here going,
no, and
no.
The thing is, if the mother didn't know, if the mother hadn't killed her husband, if he had just died in a coal mine accident, then it's fine that the journals are in a closet somewhere.
Somewhere, yeah.
But she knew.
She knew.
And yet she didn't remove every trace of her husband from that house. It's just, she murdered the man to keep him from influencing her son, but she didn't get rid of all of the traces from him around the house. No, there's no way. There is no way. And the thing is, if the journals hadn't been there and he had just, you know, you go into the genetic piece, like the piece of it's the that's genetic and the piece of it that's, you know, inherited. And if they just had him not killing them the exact same way, then you could accept it more. Like the rest of the plot works. But the fact that he learned from the journals how to serial kill, and so his dad ended up raising him despite having been murdered by his mother. No, like you can't accept that at all. There's no way to accept that. And it like kills the episode. Mm-hmm. It really does. Because there's nothing about the episode that requires him to kill the exact same way. Except for they have to have a moment where they think it might be the same guy. But that's it. And spoiler alert, like, he could have accidentally stumbled into burning them with cigarettes. You know? Also, and I want to point out, The without the being the journals and him being caused to do commit the exact same crimes, you don't even need the journals to be in the house. Like, you could just have it be that he had left information in his torture dungeon that the wife didn't know about.
Yeah.
Like, you could have done that, because the wife clearly doesn't know about the torture dungeon, because she doesn't lead them to the torture dungeon. It takes the victim to lead them to the torture dungeon.
Yeah.
So, there you go. You could have fixed it that way, but, like, no, you have the wife find out that he's a murderer, but doesn't scour the house for all of his stuff, and the journal is just lying around for JJ to find.
Yeah, I mean...
Oh, no, it hurts the episode badly.
It hurts the episode terribly.
Yeah. Oh, you know? My God. Decent profiling stuff, though, because they talk about how, you know, like, what is the kind of guy who commits this kind of crime? And it's a guy who's, you know, just a known scumbag, just a known local mm-hmm. scumbag who was violent, who was a drunk all the time. Like, you'd know this guy. Did anyone, and all they say to him is, did anyone like that die around the time
they stopped?
The murder stopped, and he's like, and right away he gets it. Like, it yeah. takes him a second to figure out who it was.
Yeah.
To the point where I'm like, if it was that easy, like, if this guy was that much of a known scumbag and then the murder stopped, wouldn't you at least entertain the possibility that that might have been him? You know? It seems weird that when that guy is so obviously a famous scumbag around town, the fact that the murder stopped right when he died, it seems weird that Morgan Shepherd couldn't have noticed that himself.
Except this was 20 years before.
More than that. Almost 30 years ago, because he died in... Oh, no, yeah, you're right. I keep forgetting it's 2007. So, yeah, you're right. It was 25 years ago.
Okay. So you're talking 25 years before, right?
So, yeah. What is the... How do they treat serial killers then?
Well, there were barely... I mean, we're still talking about the early 80s, and the serial killers that they did have were these, like, weirdos, right? I mean,
that's true.
The clowns and the, you know.
Yeah, your Gacy's and such, and your Ted Bundy. Like, he yeah. wouldn't think there had been none of the kind of research to help him, like, lock this guy down had happened.
Well, and he wouldn't have. And when you're living, again, you're living in a small rural place.
That's true.
He's a rural cop, and it just can't be one of your own. That's
true. And that has always been a problem when they're dealing with these kind of serial killers. People don't want to believe it could be their next door neighbor.
Yeah.
That's true.
It's that simple. You know,
like one of the definitive things about this is these are the kind of crimes that you always have to believe are coming from outside of your community.
Yeah. You can't know this guy.
No, you can't. No, I get that. You're absolutely right. That it makes more sense. But it is nice that the minute he tells them, he does have the guy immediately. Like, and so it is a win for profiling, I will say that. Mm-hmm. But it's a loss for writing. Because there's no way this episode happens. There's no way that the wife doesn't. And honestly, when you find out how close the torture dungeon was, you're like, really? Nobody... She never found that in all this time.
Yeah.
On her own property. She's been living there for 30 some years. Never found the torture dungeon.
Yeah. No, yeah, there was a whole bunch of things that don't that
really
just
hang together at all.
Yeah.
And that's being kind.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you know, and at least they have two sons.
Yes. They have two sons, so they can try and figure out which of the two sons it is. And I'm like, well, it's probably not the one that, you know, was raised by the rape victim. Like, just logically speaking, it's probably not him, because how would he know how the crimes were specifically committed? He can't learn the specific details. The mother didn't tell him, and you can't learn specific details through, I don't know, genetic memory.
No, there's no such
He's committing thing. The exact same crime.
Yeah. So, but, you know, I mean, that one I give them, but the, you know, because those scenes were quite good when he, you know, when he tries to tell his mother, but I always knew you were raped.
Yeah, exactly.
And obviously she had raised him well enough that he could deal with that.
Yeah. No, it's actually kind of heartwarming, the interaction between him and his mother. I did really enjoy that. You're right.
Yeah, you know, so that works, but it's just, but the end.
Oh, God, where she shoots him. Oh, where yet another generation has been murdered. I don't know if I mentioned this in my review. I must have, because my first thought was the big question is, did they remember to throw away the book this time?
Yeah. No, I think the BAU took it.
Okay, hopefully, because I'm sure that kid will be fine as long as nobody gives him a book on this stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, God. And, you know, had you just freaking gotten... I'm not saying kids 100% need a father figure, because the daughter of the son of the rape victim did just fine, but, you know, maybe you should have remarried. Just putting that out there. Because it's not like your kid's son had even been born when his dad died. He would never have known anything about his dad. Maybe consider getting remarried. I'm not saying you have to. Single mothers frequently do a great job. But in this one case, it might have behooved you to get remarried. Just putting that out there. Yeah.
Or sell the farm.
Or sell the farm. You know, maybe sell the farm.
And move.
Remember how you found the farm and there were like, and when you got into the farm and you wanted to, you know, you murdered your husband and you looked around and you found like shackles and blood-soaked torture implements everywhere. Maybe you should have taken that as like a sign to move.
Just burn it down.
Burn it down
and move.
Yeah, that would have been
or
nice.
Or burn it down. Just burn it down.
Burn it down. Oh, yeah, there was a fire. I would like the insurance, please. Go somewhere.
I'd go burn it down and don't even take the insurance.
No, take the insurance. She's got a kid to raise. Take the insurance money. It's fine. I know it's insurance fraud, but in this one case, I'm going to sign off on insurance fraud. All right. So now let's talk about Morgan Shepherd. The late Morgan Shepherd. He died last year. We were all very sad about it. He's Mark Shepherd's dad, and he is a fantastic performer.
Oh.
Oh, such a loss. Some might remember him as the computer genius who tried to steal Data's body on Star Trek: The Next Generation and turned his mind into a mental signal that may or may not have infected the Enterprise's computer. There was never really any follow-up on that. He has been in dozens of shows. There is a wonderful episode of Doctor Who. And this is a true thing that happened. So Mark Shepherd was playing an FBI agent on Doctor Who. And then they're like, okay, and end of the episode, we see you 50 years later. And like, so we're going to have to talk to you and do a head cast for some old age makeup. And Mark Shepherd was, you know, my dad's a famous actor, right?
Yeah, you know.
Like, were you not aware that my dad is a famous actor and he will be happy to play the old version of me for scale? It's fine. The weird part is they were actually, it was, the whole premise was Doctor Who goes to America for the first time. And they shot out in like the deserts of Nevada. And so they had to get an actor who was both in the British Union and also was able to work in America without a visa. And that's why Mark Shepherd's on the show. Cause he is, I think he's a dual citizen, but he can legally work in both countries. That's why they went with Mark Shepherd. And he's like, yeah, my dad too. That's fine. Like we can both work in both countries without any trouble. Don't worry about it. But yes, for us, he is and will always be Blank Reg.
Always
going to be Blank Reg. And if you don't know what, just if the term Blank Reg doesn't make you immediately happy, I'm both sorry for you and I envy you because you get to watch Max Headroom for the first time.
Oh, and it's sitting right there. I watch it every show. So often.
It's just so good.
And Blank Reg was just so
it's an amazing
wonderful.
Character. He's an amazing character. Basically, it was set 20 minutes into the future. It is a TV show from the 1980s about consumer culture and media culture and capitalism run amok. And it is the most prescient TV show you will ever see. It didn't predict the internet. It didn't understand what flat screens TVs were. Like, there's plenty of stuff it got wrong. But what it got right about culture it got, and how humans react to these move changes in technology, it got more right than any other show. And you owe it to yourself to track down and watch Max Headroom. It's available. I don't know if it's available on any streaming services. It is available on DVD. There's just 13 episodes, and it's fantastic. The idea is there. It is a future society entirely controlled by corporations, and you know, I mean, there is. I get there's a government. There's a fascist government, but we never learn that much about it because the corporations run everything.
Yeah.
But one of the things is everyone is, it is a complete and total surveillance state. And there are blanks who are people who live off of the grid. And that is what Blank Reg is. And he is the leader of a, how do I describe it? Like it's not really, I was going to say like an artists collective that are also freedom fighters. Cause in the future, it's weird to describe. Cause in the future, everything is television. There's a joke in the first episode that someone is arrested for having an off switch on their television.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, the whole show is the nightmare of, oh my God, I'm blanking on it. You know, Global Village. Marshall McLuhan. The whole episode is McLuhan's Nightmare of the Future.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Nightmare of the Future. And I mean, I still remember the Blipferts.
God, that's the first episode, but don't spoil it. Don't spoil it.
Oh.
Yeah, that's the plot of the 2-hour opening movie. But yeah, what's interesting is there, it started out as a pitch for BBC. And BBC, they filmed a 1-hour pilot. And BBC was like, this is too crazy. We can't put this on television. And then an American network did. And that is the craziest thing that's ever happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there was recasting for, there was some small recasting for the American version, but that was it. Yeah.
It was,
There was some small recasting, but it's Matt Frewer and Jeffrey Tambor and Amanda Pays, and I don't remember who else.
Who plays
Bryce.
Bryce.
Hmm. Tough.
I could look,
but anyway,
doesn't matter. Yeah, Bryce.
It's not.
Yeah, Bryce is the one that is the kid genius.
Ultimately,
that they
there's
to...
a child genius who is ultimately responsible for the creation of Max Headroom. And I guess I should explain. Max Headroom is an AI based on the mind of the main character, who is created to try and get information out of his head, and then he goes wild, and he can. By his very existence, he can hack the various computer networks that control the world. And so he's, you know, is able to help out with their crime solving, which they do every week. The main character is a news reporter, and his alter ego is this AI, Max Headroom, who can do whatever the plot requires him to.
Oh, yeah, and he can show up wherever he wants.
Exactly,
and he can
control
things he's not the same person.
No, not because, at all. And Matt Frewer's character, Addison Carter, can't control him.
No.
But he is, he is born out of his mind. Yeah. And so they at least like each other. It's an amazing TV show.
It's an amazing. And the virtual reality episode.
I know. Again, prescient. It's prescient.
Yes,
saw so much of this coming. So yeah, I can't stress enough
it was way ahead of its time. It's one of those
far ahead of its time. Yeah, and it is worth you tracking down and watching it. Fun fact, the unbelievably disastrous Super Mario Brothers movie, made by the husband and wife team who created Max Headroom.
You're kidding.
Yeah. That was their previous job. And it killed their career, making, they went from Max Headroom being like this visionary writing and directing team to being pariahs for having made the Super Mario Brothers movie. It's an amazing story, but that's for another time. The story of the Super Mario Brothers movie. But yeah, so that's Max Headroom, and that is why we will always love Morgan Shepherd. And he had an incredibly long career. The man was never off television for very long. He always did a great job, but he will always be Blank Reg.
Yeah. You know what amazes me is that who is I don't think he was ever on Supernatural.
That's weird that he never got his dad a role on Supernatural.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. By the way, Mark Shepherd, in case you don't know, he's the devil on Supernatural. Not the devil, but you know, the king of the the main villain on the show.
Yeah, the king of the demons, the king of the underworld.
Yeah, like the one who's actually a demon, because of course Lucifer is an angel.
And his mother is still around.
Nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway. So it's a wonderful, Morgan Shepherd's amazing. And Morgan Shepherd is there in this episode to give, to remind Rossi to go and solve the crime that's been haunting him all this
yes.
time, because he sees that it gives some measure of peace to Morgan Shepherd to have finally solved the crime that
yeah.
That has been haunting him all this time. And so that motivates him to, in the episode Damaged, finally get that. So remember how you said last week, when we were talking about last week's episodes, that the show is not good with consistency,
mm-hmm.
right? And how, because I said, in this episode, Derek finds out, in the episode Penelope, Derek finds out that she was a hacker who was recruited,
yeah.
right? But then in the episode The Black Queen, we find out Derek was one of the guys who recruited her. So that episode, like, it completely invalidates
yeah,
that because
yeah.
they don't care about continuity. Here's the first major, well, second major time that happened after, you know, assigning Derek L's backstory. But I will never give up on that. Anyway, what's interesting is, sorry, I just had a flash to the terrible episode where Derek goes to a thing honoring his father and his father's partner and then gives a speech that makes it entirely about him. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, Derek.
We'll
you were the
there.
Worst. We'll
okay.
get there. But no, no, I'm sorry for drifting
we'll
off my
there.
Point. We'll get there. I'm drifting away from my point.
Back off.
Which is, in this episode, Rossi, in no uncertain terms, with no possible way to get around the information, says a family was murdered on Christmas Eve. A family was bludgeoned to death on Christmas Eve. Those are the words he says. There is no way to reinterpret what he says. There is no way to change what he says. A family was murdered on Christmas Eve. Criminal Minds was going to do a Killer Santa episode. And then there was a strike, so new TV wasn't being made at Christmas. So when they finally got around, rather than waiting a year and doing it in season 4, the way they probably should have, or just, this is the important part, like, solving the crime in March, but still admitting it happened in Christmas? Like, they had this crazy idea that they so fell in love with the idea of David Rossi solving the crime on exactly the 22nd anniversary of the day the crime happened, that, like, even though this episode is airing in February or March, the original crime can still have happened at Christmas. But the show is so blinkered and so set on this one thing, David Rossi solves the crime 22 years to the day later, that they kind of screwed themselves. Or, you know what? Friggin' air an episode in March that is set at Christmas. Who cares? Do you think people are going to stop watching Criminal Minds because you aired your Christmas episode in March? Guess what? People know there was a writer's strike. Like, it really bothers me.
We all knew there was a writer's strike.
We were there for it, okay? We know the writer's strike happened. We're not going to,
we
gonna,
saw
like...
a lot of movies.
We saw a lot of movies. We watched a lot of reality television. David Letterman came back, like, no one else. David Letterman, because he owns the company that produced his show, Worldwide Pants, just went to the union and said, just give the writers whatever they want.
Yeah.
He's like, I'll just pay the writer. He was like, union, I would like to pay the writers whatever they want. Can I go back to being on television? And the union was like, fine.
Yeah. You know? I'll settle with you.
Yeah, because David Letterman wasn't part of an evil cartel, which the rest of the TV industry was. But let's not get political. So yeah, it's frustrating because in this episode, they full on say Criminal Minds is going to do a Killer Santa episode, and then they don't go through with it. And that ticks me off so much. All right. So yeah, that is the episode Birthright. Let's move on to our third episode of the evening, which is Third Life. That was a nice coincidence.
When a teenager is found dead and her best friend is reported missing, the BAU launches an intense manhunt in Chula Vista, California, for the unsub, only to learn that the missing girl's disappearance is connected to a crime. Oh, God. They didn't watch the episode.
I know. No, it was not connected to another crime.
Wait, nope. Connected to a crime her father witnessed 10 years.
What? Later.
That's what it says. I'm going,
oh my God, this person didn't watch the episode at all. Oh, that's so much worse. That's so much worse than I thought it was going to be. No, he was a murderer. He was a murderer for the Boston Irish mob.
Yeah, he was a hitman.
He was a hitman for the mob. He was not a witness to a crime. Oh my God, we've had a lot of bad synopsises here.
This one is the worst.
This is probably the worst synopsis we've ever had. So
because this is definitely,
you've missed the entire point of the episode.
Yeah, you didn't get it, eh? Okay, can I ask you something bizarre?
Of course.
Chula Vista, this place takes place in Chula Vista, California.
Okay.
What else has taken place in Chula Vista?
I can't tell you that. I know nothing. The name means nothing to me.
There's some episode of something, whether
like,
it was
so
the
name Chula Vista really just jumped out at you. This is definitely familiar. Okay.
And I'm going, that the tribe? No, the tribe took place in New Mexico.
No, it was in New Mexico because it was all around the native land.
Never mind. It doesn't matter.
All right. Okay.
Totally unimportant. I just thought.
No, yeah, it's not related.
Well, maybe, anyway. It'll come to me at some point.
Hopefully.
Third Life. It was actually, okay, so
it's not a terrible episode, but something bothers me in the episode. So they have this fetish on the show. Oh, yeah, there's one thing I can't believe we forgot to mention this. The actual most interesting thing in the episode Birthright, other than Morgan Shepherd, is, and the terrible plotting is, there's a scene where Aaron is like, hey, JJ, you decide what cases we take. And I can't help notice that we're always taking cases where women who look like you get murdered. Is that something you're making us do? Like, maybe you should analyze what cases you prioritize, JJ. Because it seems like you're working through your own stuff and using the BAU to do it. And I'm like, wow, I had totally forgotten that they actually called out and tried to make a point about how they only work cases where pretty young girls get killed. I mean, that scene and that line never go anywhere. It's just such a weird thing to see the show call out.
Yeah, every now and then you get that, though. Every now and then you get this
wink. This, like, this wink of self-awareness from the show. And I'm like, it's weird that he says that, though. It's really weird that he says that.
Yeah, well, we can always wonder whether or not that was a line he put in himself.
Yes, or at least one of the producers was very aware of and troubled by this fact.
Okay, no. Here's why I'm going to say this.
Okay.
Fisher and Messer wrote Birthright. We're going to go back to Birthright for a second.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so
okay.
Fisher and Messer wrote Birthright. Now, I can't see them
putting that line in.
Putting that line in.
No, that had to be somebody else.
No, also know that when Thomas Gibson gets fired, one of the issue that while it's not totally clear, but when I read that basically the issue was that there was a line in his script
that he was not willing to say.
He wanted changed because it didn't fit with the character.
Huh.
Okay. And so Virgil Williams wouldn't do anything, wouldn't change it, blah, blah, blah. It was already set. Well,
and they got into a scuffle. And
then, of course, so we could go back and say maybe, and my comment when I read that, right, when he got fired and we were talking about it, I'm going, well, it seems like maybe he has the fewest Prentice Awards because he actually cares about his character's dialogue and consistency in his character, which is what made him so consistent throughout every.
No matter who was running the show.
Who was running the show. Hotch has been consistent throughout. And so now I go back and you mentioned this and then I'm going, yeah, but. You know, Erica Messer was the showrunner and the executive producer and everything of the show when he got fired.
Yeah.
I really wonder whether, you know, anyway.
All right. Well, that's something we can hopefully we'll be able to find out more about in the future. But for right now, we're going to talk about Third Life.
Third Life.
Thanks for letting me go back and do that. So this, once again, is based on a film Just like the Crow episode was based on a film, this is also based on a film. It is based on the film Last House on the Left, which is loosely based on Ingmar Bergman's The Virgin Spring, which is itself based on folk tales from medieval times. And the premise is a woman is a young girl is raped and murdered by brigands. And then those brigands, you know, on a rainy night, come to the house or inn or castle, depending on which version, of her parents. And the parents don't even know that their daughter is dead yet at the point. But then they see that these guys have the property of their daughter, and so they kill her. So then they kill the brigands. And that is the plot. That is the old folk tale, and that is the plot of The Virgin Springs. That is the plot of The Last House on the Left. And this one basically follows that track, except the BAU is involved. Mm-hmm. Although the BAU is not involved in how it is solved. This is, if I didn't give it a zero, I should have, because one of the two dads knows who the killer is.
Yeah.
And he just tells the other dad, and the other dad murders him.
Yeah.
Oof. So let's get into the morality of vigilantism.
Well, there's a whole bunch of issues of morality here. You know,
yeah.
I think that you can now here. It's, I mean, the best line of the whole show is when, you know, when Reed's going, but your wife, well, you know, and teacher, blah, 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 blah. I'll start tomorrow.
I know. Isn't that beautiful? Oh, you know, when does it stop? When do you stop living a life of violence? Tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Boom. Thank you. Oh, that made me so happy. Oh, well, and that's the thing. It's like, so God, the show really wants to not come down on the side of vigilantism, but it's hard to argue with the vigilante's case this time. Like, you know, girl got murdered. A girl got brutally murdered. And yeah, only one of the three teens was leading the other two into violence. The other two were just followers and hangers on. And that's true, but they all murdered a girl and they were all gonna murder another girl. Like, they were rapists and torturers and murderers. And no matter how hard I try, I can't feel bad for them dying badly.
No, you can't. In fact, well, one survives.
The one does survive. Well, we think he survived. Oh, no, wait. They do mention that he's found, right?
Yeah, they find him.
Yeah, they find him before he bleeds to death.
Yeah, and that's why they know
where they are. No, weirdly, they know where they are, because Reed is just like, I think they're definitely at the school. Oh, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you just knew that right away, Reed? Yep.
And as usual, Reed goes in without backup.
He's in a police station. He's in a police station. They're like, it's going to take us 10 minutes to get there. I'm only 5 minutes away. And he goes in alone. I'm like, you're in a police station. You were surrounded by police officers. Bring the police officers.
Well, my line is, what? You learned nothing?
No, he learns nothing.
You know what happened the last time you went in alone?
I know. Oh, God. And this time he gets mentally scarred because he sees a guy get his head blown off at point blank range. And I'm like, yeah, I would not be that scarred by that. Like, the visceral unpleasantness, yes, of seeing that happen. But then again, you know, you've seen a lot of dead bodies, like a lot of dead bodies. Like, there is no shortage to the number of dead bodies you've seen. And so this guy getting killed, How can you be that upset about it?
But, I mean, Reed already knows that this guy is a hitman.
Yeah, he knows the guy's a hitman. He knows the other guy is a rapist. Like, it's fine. Like, how does he think he's going to talk him out of this?
Yeah, the guy is a hitman for the mob and is only, you know, has only turned on the mob because the mob accidentally
killed his wife.
You know, they were going to kill, they were trying to kill, maybe Reed doesn't get that, but they were trying to kill him,
and they killed his wife,
so he turned on them.
Yeah,
he turns on them. He has a reason to turn on them.
It's not because he had a crisis of conscience.
No, he didn't have a crisis. This is my payback. You killed my wife. I'm paying you back.
Yeah. Like he's still just a guy in the world of violence and payback. He's just getting his revenge by other means.
Yeah.
And those means are he's using the FBI to get back at the guys who killed his wife.
To take
and that. Yeah. He also promised his wife that he would look out for their daughter and stop being a murderer. You know? And that's fine.
Well,
and
I'm not
you're not sure that he actually did that?
I'm not sure he said he would stop being a murderer. Reed takes that as given.
As what he meant. You're right.
But he said that he promised his wife he would take care of his daughter.
That's true. He didn't actually specifically, he might not have promised I'll stay completely out of the life and not be a person of violence anymore. You're right. I am reading that into it just the same way Reed did.
Reed read that into it. And I'm sitting there going, Reed, that's not what he promised his wife.
No, he promised he would always look after their daughter. And
killing this kind of qualifies.
Killing this guy who presumably sexually assaulted your daughter. Yeah, I would say this, they're very nebulous, and murdered her best friend. You know, that seems to fall quite neatly under the category of protecting your daughter.
Yeah. And, I mean, that was, and as I said, those sometimes, and I think that's what Simon Mirren intended for sure.
Yeah.
Like, he does know what he's writing.
That's true.
The father just says that he will take care of he will protect his daughter, take care of his daughter.
No, I think your reading is right. I think I was misunderstanding it. I'm pretty sure your reading is dead on this one.
Well, I think people want to believe what Reed was saying, and and that's
too big. I took it as read the same way a lot of people I assume did. But yeah, you're probably right that never entered into his head.
No. Now he's going to stop killing because he's promised the FBI to
see. Yeah, he wouldn't.
But this time, and then you get that end line where, well, it depends on how badly they need him.
I know. And obviously they needed him quite badly. Yeah.
Very, very, very clearly. Well, yeah. Take down the whole organization.
And when it comes down to it, you know, it's like nobody's going to care that some high school rapists got shot. Like when it comes to shocking the sensibilities of the people in charge of the witness relocation and protection program, they're not going to care that a couple of high school rapists got shot fundamentally. I mean, if he had done that after he was finished testifying.
Yes.
Yeah. And he was just one of their relocations. Yeah. He'd be in jail. But since they still need him, no, he gets a pass.
Yeah, and it's the same, but it falls under the same category as all of those gang guys in True Night, right?
Exactly.
They're all horrible, horrible, horrible human beings.
Yeah, and it's the kind of situation where you really believe the cops, the FBI, the the Department of Justice would be willing to look the other way.
You realize that we can now have are we doing these in threes? You can actually connect these three episodes because, of course, in Birthright, do you think that the pregnant wife is going to go to jail for shooting?
No. Nope.
No.
No. No one's going to. I mean, Morgan Shepherd. Oh, no, he wasn't there then. The sheriff. He was the old sheriff. No, the current sheriff is going to hear her story. He came at me and I had to shoot him. And everyone is just going to say, yep, sounds good to me.
Yep. This bastard killed and tortured all of these women. Yep, sounds good to me. Got three vigilante episodes where
in a row. That is weird, right?
Yeah, and where frankly, right?
It was deserved every time.
It was deserved every time. This is not these, you know,
these are not episodes designed to trouble the sensibilities.
Not really. I mean, yes, at a bigger level, I do have problems with vigilantes, but
of course, no, 100%.
But and the thing is, although I would say, okay, in Third Life, he's not a vigilante such.
He's just getting revenge.
It's the interesting thing with the father of the girl who was murdered.
Yep, handing over the name
goes and then says to them, he says, "I want to apologize to him."
Yes.
Right?
For accusing him of being involved. And then he walks in and just like, here's the guys, go get him.
Yeah, he said, "I want to apologize. I don't know what you did. I don't care what you did.
But could you do it again?
But if there is any, I know who did this, and could you? If there's anything you can do about it. It's a beautiful scene. Yeah.
It really is a beautiful scene.
And you see that. Well, I mean, I don't know if I would ever do that. I don't think that I would allow myself to do that. But God only knows I would want to.
Yeah. Well, it takes a lot of internal strength to go in and say, could you murder somebody for me?
Yeah. And no repercussions. But the thing is the father does this because he knows that his daughter would not have willingly, that this was his daughter's best friend, that she finally had this really great life and a really close friend.
Yeah.
And they had a really good life. The daughter was doing well.
Yep.
And all of those things. And then it's of course, and he's taught his daughter to avoid, well, because he knows what these guys are like. He knows what guys are like. He knows what these horrible guys are like, so all the time. So he's prepped his daughter.
He's trained her. He's trained her for how to deal with these type of guys.
Yeah. They are bad guys. Stay away from them. And it's of course the
other daughter who doesn't know.
Yeah, who
doesn't know this world and doesn't know what these people are like.
Well, no, she has this myth about the bad guy, the James Dean character, you know?
Yeah, the James Dean bad boy type of situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's 3 pro-vigilante episodes in a row. That is weird.
Yeah, it is weird. And that there were...
Because I don't think the writers would have defined Birthright as a pro-vigilanteism episode, but you're right, it absolutely is.
In the end, yeah, because you don't...
Because not only is that woman, that pregnant lady, not going to jail...
Neither is for, the mother.
For a shooting, the mother ain't going to jail for pushing the first murder into that combine harvester. She's not going to jail for that.
No.
100%. She is not going to jail for that. She confessed in front of 8 cops and no one thinks for a second. No one slaps bracelets on her. No one mentions it. Everyone's just like, nah, that's fine.
Yeah.
He had it coming.
He had it coming.
Cause we're in this weird bind, right? Because obviously any rapist deserves to die. I mean, that's just a fact, right? Like there's anyone who is a rapist can be killed and no one should feel bad about that. And it's just, that's just a fact. But there is, at the same time, you can't encourage vigilantism. Mm-mm. Because the world is too messy to allow for the kind of moral clarity that fiction offers.
Yeah.
Fiction offers you moral clarity in a way that does not exist in the real world. And that's why we can enjoy fiction about vigilantes when we would never want that to happen in real life.
No, you can't, because it's too messy and they make too many mistakes. And
exactly.
Even this mother, I mean, as you say, it's fiction.
Yeah.
You know, fiction is controlled.
Yep.
We talk about that, you know.
We talk about that all the time.
Yeah. Who are fiction's gods?
Yeah. Well, as I said, it's always kind of silly. It's always kind of silly to have an atheist in fiction. Because atheists live in fictional characters live in a world where there is a creator God responsible for everything that happens to them.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And let me tell you, the criminal minds gods is really, is not a...
Not a good God. No.
Not a consistent God at all.
At the least. The very least. It is not a consistent God where there are rules for how to please them.
Yeah.
There are no clear rules for how to get on the side of the God of criminal minds.
Except just remember, you may get away with 2 or 3, but...
That you may get away with 2 murders. That third murder, that's what's going to get you.
Yeah. Just don't do the third murder and you might be able to get away with it.
Yeah, you might.
But the BAU will find you.
Oh, totally. So yeah, it's a fun episode, although it does do one thing that I always find unpleasant, which is the scene where they wallow in the misery of parents of dead children, because they're like, someone has to listen to this tape to find out which of these 2 girls is murdered, to which I say, I don't know that they do. They're like, because then they say, we've got to know who we're looking for. Do you, though? How does finding out who you're looking for change what your actions are? And it doesn't. Nothing about knowing who they're looking for changes what they do. Like, I feel like you made those parents listen to that tape for no reason.
Is this really your daughter?
Like, oh, the DNA test will get back to us too late. We might not find out who did it. How does knowing which one is dead affect your investigative cases in any way, shape, or form?
No.
After they find out that the one guy's daughter is dead and the other one's daughter isn't, what is changed?
Nothing.
Nothing is changed.
Except so it's we know like, which father is going to do the killing and which father is going to ask.
But at the same time, if his daughter, like, that guy would have gone and killed either way.
Yeah.
Like, because the thing is, whether it was his daughter who was still abducted or whether it was his daughter who was dead, he was going to go kill that guy.
Yeah.
Right? The only thing that changes, and you are right about this, the only thing that changes is Brian McNamara knowing his daughter is, I mean, actually, it might not change it. Because Brian McNamara, knowing his daughter is dead, gives him the mental push to say, go kill them. But at the same time, if the mobster's daughter was dead and Brian McNamara's daughter was still alive and might be rescuable, he still would have said to the mob guy, your daughter's dead, you can save my daughter, go kill them. Like, it actually would have played out. This is, he would have, like, the guy would have
done whatever
that guy
it is.
Either way.
Do whatever it is to make sure that my daughter at least comes out alive.
Yeah. You can save my daughter and you can get revenge. Like, the episode would have played out exactly the same way if they didn't know which one was dead the whole time. So it just seems like this criminal minds misery porn thing that I always recoil from in the show. You know, and I mean, it's not like this is the only time that happens. This is just a notably awful version of it. It's not the most awful version of it. That's coming still.
Yeah.
But it is an incredibly awful example of it. But I will say, I mean, it's a satisfying episode of television.
No, this one. That's the funny thing.
It's a satisfying episode. It is.
Yeah. And the first one, you feel terribly, terribly, terribly sorry.
Yeah.
Right.
You feel so sad for the, you feel so sad for Malcolm.
Yeah.
The
you really, really
is,
do.
Is so dumb.
Yeah.
It's got this plot hole.
That makes no sense
right at the core of it. Right. That keeps you from being able to take it seriously. But this one, it's a satisfying hour of television.
You'll feel
good walking away from this hour of television. You're like, yep, I got what I wanted. There was a twisted group of murderers out there, and then they got shot by a mobster. Thank you, television, for making my dreams come true.
Yeah.
That's all we want.
Yeah, and the hitman got away.
And the hitman got away with it.
And is going to live a life of nonviolence from then on.
He'll be fine from then on. It's not like another... In the episode, they're like, oh, but they're still out there. Is this still a danger? I'm like, no. Not unless... You know, another group of rapists and murderers show up to attack his daughter again. It's not like he did it because he was psyched to murder those guys. He did it for a good reason.
Like, it's so funny, right? Because, I mean, Katie's father and him get along just fine. They've been great friends in the whole thing. Everything has just been perfect until this particular situation happened.
He's had no trouble living for 5 years in this life, and as you said, he should have no trouble going right back to it.
Because being a hitman for him was a job.
He's not getting paid to do it anymore.
He wasn't a hitman for the mob because
the Richard Kuklinski story we saw back in season one, where he was a guy with major problems who, as they said, turned his hobby into a job.
Yeah.
That's how they described their version of the Iceman in that season, what, one episode?
Yeah.
It was very early. No, I'm sure it was season one. That episode, it dealt with some of the, like, the hitman from the mob, but it was taking it from a completely different point of view. Yeah, and a completely different idea of it. Whereas this one is just like, no, like, it's just a job for him. Yeah, I'm sure he has an empathy disorder. You can't murder professionally without having an empathy disorder. But he also doesn't crave murder, and he doesn't get off on murder. No. To say the reason he's different is, and I mean, it's horrible. It's horribly bleak to describe it this way. His sexual orientation isn't murder.
Yeah.
And that is what differentiates serial killers from people who just kill professionally. Yeah. For serial killers, their sexual orientation is death.
Which is why snipers in the military, some of them can come back, and yes, they have some PTSD or they have some problems, but they don't keep killing.
No.
Whereas the ones that have these other issues, if they are not controlled within the military, the minute they're let out and have access to guns, they go crazy.
Yeah, it can happen. It does happen.
You know? A lot.
It really does happen. It happens more than I think people are comfortable acknowledging.
Oh, well, yeah, look at the mass murder down in Florida about a year and a half ago. God, the whole family in church, you know. What? And they knew it. Bad. And he shouldn't. Yeah. Anyway, I don't want to go there.
We're not getting into American gun culture. That's a whole other conversation.
No, and we're not getting into
the show Criminal Minds. Yeah, that the show Criminal Minds is never willing to talk about.
Not really.
You will never find the show Criminal Minds mentioning American gun culture. It's just not something that concerns the show Criminal Minds.
No, there's a couple of, every now and then there's the odd thing.
There's the odd slightest mention of something tertiarily related to American gun culture.
Like, well,
but fundamentally.
Why do you need all those guns? It was, and when, you know.
Yeah.
But
that might be a line once in a blue moon, but that will be it.
Yeah.
Like, this is not a show that is, you know, criticizing that kind of central aspect of American life. Which is too bad, because, you know, they work for the FBI, and guess what? The FBI generally doesn't like American gun culture in real life, because they don't like knowing that at any point one of the doors they knock on might have an assault rifle behind it.
Yeah.
If it were up to the FBI, no one but the FBI would have guns. They might be even a little worried about regular cops having guns. Yeah.
The military.
If it were up to the
military. The military. Of course, the military. Can have guns.
But the military doesn't operate inside America, so that's not even something they would worry about.
Yeah. It's interesting because the end of this episode, I really wonder how people really watch it. Because to me, the takeaway should be from the very end of the episode is that the daughter has now taken the name Katie in honor of her friend, right? And
it's a nice takeaway.
And it's not a
She's going to remember her friend.
Yeah.
They act like it's scary. And I'm like, it's not scary.
She's
remembering her friend. She's honoring her friend.
Yes. And that's
exactly fine.
And she had done that before when she picked her last name, you know, so, and now she has her friend's name and she will remember her friend forever.
Yeah. It's kind of sweet.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's
sweet by Criminal Minds stand, like it's Criminal Minds version of sweet.
Well, it is Simon Mirren.
Yeah. It's Simon Mirren. He's a bleak dude. Everyone knows that about Simon Mirren.
But this,
again, this... Helen Mirren's nephew. I always find that weird. I mean, and I'm not saying he shouldn't be allowed to work in American television, but like everybody needs a job. He's a writer. It's just so weird that it's Helen Mirren's nephew.
And he does have an English accent.
Well, of course he is English. Like it's just weird that he's like, oh no. Yeah. It's not just a name. He's related to that famous person named Mirren.
Yeah.
And was the daughter played by Joe Mantegna's daughter?
It might have been. She looked
in the credits. I saw somebody Mantegna, and I'm like, "Is the new Katie? Is his daughter played by Joe Mantegna's daughter?" Because I think she might be.
Okay.
Well, I definitely saw a girl named Mantegna in the credits. You know what? I'm going to pause the recording. You go check IMDb.
I am doing that right now.
Okay. The result is
Gia Mantegna, and that's his daughter.
All right. I assumed as much when I saw Mantegna in there, but it's good to have it confirmed. So yeah, it's an episode that is, I'm not going to say it's troubling, but they so aggressively approve of vigilantism in this episode that it always gives me pause as someone who has had our, I think, you know, clearly articulated issues with that.
Well, I mean, the whole thing is you have to be vigilant. You have to be anti-vigilante because vigilantism just doesn't work. You can't have a society where people just decide. Because how many time, you know, to go off and kill? I mean, fiction is fine because it's always clear.
Yeah. You know who the bad guys are.
We always, well, yes. And as I said, and it's even in Law and Order sex crimes, you know who the bad guy is. It's just sometimes you don't get him. Whereas here, generally speaking, not always, Criminal Minds does every now and then. There are ambiguous things. There have been already.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, you can't allow it if you want to have a society that's going to function and going to work for everyone.
Yeah. You need the same laws to, I mean, and that's the same reason I'm against that. I can at the same time say, yeah, of course, every rapist needs to die, but I have to also be against the death penalty.
Well, yeah.
I can't be for the death penalty. Right? As a society.
As a society, I think, well, yes, because killing is wrong. And murder is wrong. That's the whole point here.
Is murder wrong or is it?
Murder is wrong. And if murder is wrong, then you cannot have state-sanctioned murder.
No.
And partly because you think, because most people somehow or another think that if you murder, and it's first-degree murder, if you murder the person that murdered your loved one, then somehow or another, that's going to balance the scales and you're going to feel better.
And I'm sure that's not true.
And most of the time, I would say 80% of the time, that is not true. Now, for someone like our hitman here.
Yes, obviously that makes sense.
Who has an empathy disorder.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a different story for a guy like him. Yes, that's true.
It's a different story, and there will be people who will. But for the most part, it doesn't take. Why? You know, I mean, this is what I say about. I mean, people who are so focused on destruction. You do what you have to do.
Yeah.
You know, as much as you can, but it doesn't take away. The memories, it doesn't take away the loneliness, it doesn't take, you know, the fact that the steel plant. So I could have blown up the steel plant after my father got killed at the steel plant.
Would it have accomplished anything? No.
I still miss my father. It doesn't matter whether the steel plant is blown up or not.
Yeah.
You know,
and
I mean,
you can blame the people responsible. You could get money, blah, blah, blah. It's you're fundamentally not. It doesn't fix anything.
Well, and it's the same thing. Like it's the same thing with, and we'll get into it with a lot of these other abuse cases and things where people get these huge settlements.
Yeah.
And somehow or another think that that's going to make
you're going to make them feel better.
You have to tell me. Oh, my phone's ringing, but I don't know. Oh, it's Bell Canada. Who cares? Sorry.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. So this is, no, but you can't, you have to have a society that works for everyone. Like and
you need the laws Walmart, to be the same for everybody, and you have to have guiding principles that are always true. And if we're a society that believes that murder is wrong, and I would like to live in a world that believes that murder is wrong, thank you very much, then you can't have the state sponsoring murder. And someone might say, well, what about war? And I'm like, I'm against war too.
That's right. I still will hold with what if they gave a war and nobody came.
Exactly.
Go listen to the Vietnam rag if you want to know what's wrong with war. And just because people, now, the only thing I could say about war is that it controls your psychopaths.
we round up all the psychopaths in one nice controllable place. So
and
that
as
is
long
good.
As you... Okay, as long as you keep them there.
Yeah, we don't have any problems.
And you don't allow. Yeah, I've just finished reading two Andrew Vax novels, right? Now, mind you, I'm sure he has no problem with, as we know, with vigilantes and all of that.
His comes from a very honest place of knowing this stuff never gets solved.
Well, it never gets solved. That's the problem. I mean, okay, so, and that is... This is where, I mean, I understand the argument for just killing somebody.
Oh, yeah.
Although it turns out that not so much in Canada, but in the United States, it's more, well, I don't think it would be in Canada. We don't have the death penalty. Nope. Haven't had it for so long. But it is more death penalty cases are more expensive to the state.
Oh, no, that's far more expensive. It is more expensive to kill someone than it is to lock them up for the rest of their life. That's just a fact. Like, that's true.
Well, yeah, because, of course, they have appeal after appeal after appeal.
There's and I love that, by the way, I love the people whose response to that is, well, just let them have less appeals and make it more likely to kill an innocent person? Like, because that's what lowering the amount of appeals get you. And what it comes down to is, America has wrongfully executed so many people. Like, America's justice system is so broken. How can you sign off on America's of all justice systems having the power of life and death over people?
Yeah.
America's justice system.
Yeah. You know,
it has killed so many innocent people.
Yeah. And it is one thing. And yes, I mean, and these people that you deal with in these shows, and I think that's one of the problems with so many of these shows, right?
Yeah.
That it gives you the idea that there are more of these people than there really are. So
that is the biggest issue, I think.
Right.
It posits a world that is full of just insane monsters everywhere you look.
And there isn't. It just there isn't so. And then there are people like Gary Gilmore who just said, please kill me.
Yeah.
Just please let it be done. I can't, you know.
Oh, poor Gary Gilmore. What a mess that whole situation was.
Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of things, right?
There are exceptions. Obviously, there are exceptions.
And you can't. But the problem is, right, is that you can't. If there are people that can be rehabilitated, these are not people that can be rapists. It's almost impossible.
No, you can't rehabilitate a rapist. Their crimes are informed by a corrupt worldview that is central to who they are.
Well, yeah, and it was set in place so long before.
So long, yeah.
You know, like the it stems from this very negative attitude towards women that starts very, very young, and then just, you know, women become objects and they rape, and to shift that and to change that is very, very difficult. Pedophiles.
It's almost impossible.
All of these people, these serial killers.
Well, I think the fun statistic to remember is, and this is true, the crime that is least likely to be committed by someone who gets out of jail, like, so you question, people get out of jail and you always wonder, are they going to go back to crime? The crime that is least likely to be committed a second time is murder. And that's just a fact. Like, if you killed somebody and you get out of jail, it is statistically almost impossible that you're going to murder another person. It just doesn't happen.
If
you're not a serial killer. Obviously, if you're not a serial killer.
Well, yeah, because a lot of murder is accidental.
Murder is spur of the moment, rage-related crime.
Yeah.
Most murder is spur
of the moment. You hit somebody too hard.
Yeah, you're mad at someone in a moment, often because you're drunk, and then you kill somebody, and you didn't mean to kill somebody, and you never do anything like that again. That is most murders. Most murders are not organized crime related. They're not serial killer related. So weirdly, and sometimes it's just like a crime you were committing and it got out of hand, right?
Yeah,
that can happen too. And that stuff, they don't go and they don't do that again. Because why would they? You know, they didn't commit the crime because they wanted to kill somebody, right?
Yeah.
And that is the difference. And that is the key difference between people who commit sexual assault versus people who commit murder. You can inadvertently, you can start out doing something else and end up killing somebody. You can't start out doing something else and then commit a violent sexual assault.
Yeah.
Like, you can't, like... And I mean, what it comes down to is people are like, how can you say rape is a worse crime than murder? Because there can be a reason to kill somebody.
Yeah.
It exists within the framework of reality that I could have a good reason to kill someone. You can't, there is no existence of a situation that there is a good reason to commit sexual assault. It can't happen.
Yeah.
And that is why rape is a worse crime than murder, because rape tells you all you need to know. The very fact that they committed a rape tells you all you need to know about the rapist. Okay, we got really dark here at the end. Well, so thank you for staying. But it's Criminal Minds. I'm not going to apologize for being dark.
No, I mean, it's a dark, dark TV show in many ways. Yeah. I guess that's, you know, we need to get these things out of our system, too.
That's why we do this. You know, that's, well, we're still figuring out why we're doing this. Like, that's the thing about Criminal Minds. That's
and
the thing about profiling Criminal Minds. We're here to talk about why people like Criminal Minds.
Yeah, and the funny thing is that what you're just saying is the exact situation in Birthright that the mother never killed anybody again.
Nope.
The wife is never going to kill anybody. And
there you go.
And she had a good reason to kill him.
There's a good reason. There can be a good reason to kill a person. There can't be a good reason to commit sexual assault. It's not possible. Yeah. Anyway, so on that amazingly bleak note, we're going to wrap up this week's episode. Thank you so much for dropping by with us. What have we got planned for next week?
Next week,
I know first up is my in air quotes favorite episode of Criminal Minds is on.
The one you hate the most.
It is the one I hate the most. I mean, I've always been open about that. I despise this episode of Criminal Minds. And you're like, you have 1,000 reasons for, you know, why you can't sign off on Derek Morgan. I got one episode that tells you why I will never trust David Rossi. And it is the episode Limelight.
Limelight, yeah. And then the next one is Damaged.
Which is the Killer Santa episode.
Yes,
Killer Santa episode.
Yes. And then the next one is Higher Power. So we've got another Angel of Death thing.
Yeah, that's not a bad episode. I remember that one being okay. Although it could be I'm remembering badly. That's happened in the past. It should be a good one next week. So if you're following along with us, that is Criminal Minds 313 through 315. We will see you back here for that. If you'd like to get in touch with us, check out profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com to send us an email there. If you'd like to share your thoughts on Criminal Minds, if we got something wrong, let us know. And more importantly, give us information about other profiling related TV shows, books, whatever we can check out as we continue our investigation into how profiling is treated in fiction. So we will see you back here for that. But until then, I'm going to say au revoir.
And I'm going to say, and please, if there is anything else, let us know, because we're going through these really fast.
We really are. All right. See you back here for that. Lights.
Bye.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.